Most antennas for the area where you and I live, Lou, are rated for 30 pounds per square foot. That equals something like 80 miles an hour. In other words, your exact piece of property is going to be hit with greater than 80 miles an hour once per 50 years. I know you can think back to Hurricane Gloria, where bigger numbers occurred. However, how often does your exact piece of property hit numbers like that? And the answer is once per 50 years. So we tend to design antennas for a once per 50 year event. And if you really want to be enthusiastic, you design not for 30 pounds per square foot, you design for 45 or 50 or whatever. Now, when the piece of tubing is not square, a flat sheet of metal, but it is round, the nice thing is that now you use the one-third rule. The air will flow around that piece of tubing, and it only gives you one-third the wind pressure that you would have as if it was square and flat. And as such, your 5/6 of a square foot, divide that by 3, it would be 5/18. So in other words, your piece of tubing, 2-inch diameter, 5 feet long, has a wind area of 5/18 of a square foot. And you could work out the mathematics of that. The book that describes all this, the specification, is called the TIA-RS-222. In other words, TIA is the name of the organization. RS-222 is the name of the spec, and the spec is now probably up to Rev F or Rev G. So if you go to a good technical library and you ask for the specification TIA-RS-222-F, and probably there's 5 websites that'll have that, they got all the mathematics for calculating wind load of towers, square tubing, round tubing, L-shaped legs on the tower, various antennas, parabolic dish antennas. For instance, what is the wind load? It's a function of how big is the mesh, how big is the dish, how deep is the dish, is the wind coming the front from the side, is the dish aimed straight up in the air. There's a bunch of variables. And you get more than just wind load. You also get a lift effect. When the dish is aimed to the north and the wind blows from the east, not only is there a force on that wind blowing from the east toward the west, in other words, a western going force, there's also a northern going force because the dish has got a lift characteristic like a wing. All of that's carried in that RS-222 spec. Let's see, now your second question was on the subject of the log periodic. Once you know how a log periodic works, you'll be able to make a pretty good guess on this one, Lou. And here's the way a log works. Most log periodics are really a kind of twin lead. If you look at the main boom that holds all the elements, on most log periodic designs, there are 2 booms side by side, or 2 booms one above the other, but there are 2 booms. The feed line goes down the center of one of those booms, comes out the front end of the antenna, the shield gets connected to the one it went down, the center conductor goes to the other. So the way the log periodic works is that you've got 2 booms, and from the nose of the antenna, you're launching a signal between the 2 booms as if it was twin lead. Sticking out from those booms to the left and the right, you've got these little spikes, these monopoles that look like dipoles, so to speak. The signal flows down the twin lead of the 2 booms until it hits the elements that are resonant. Then it starts radiating from those elements. The first elements it hits are the ones that are a little bit too short, because the front of the antenna has got short elements and the back of the antenna has got long elements. So the signal first hits the short elements, then it hits the medium-shaped sized elements, then it hits the elements that are a little bit too long for that frequency. Those 3 sets of elements become a 3-element Yagi. The short ones are the director, the long ones, the medium-sized ones for that wavelength are the driven element, and the long ones are the reflector. So you get a kind of 3-element Yagi performance out of a log periodic whenever you use it at the design frequency region. In general, at the design frequency region, you're lighting up 3 sets of elements at a time, as director, driven element, and reflector. Even though they're all driven, that's the way it works. So the highest frequency the Yagi works at is a function of how short or how long are the shortest elements up front. When they are approximately a half wavelength long or a little bit shorter, that's the highest frequency the log periodic is designed for. when the back end of the log periodic, the long element, the second to the longest element, that represents the half wavelength at the lowest frequency where it's rated. Go lower in frequency, you may only light up the last element as a dipole, and you start going from a Yagi pattern to a dipole pattern. Go lower in frequency than that, and you've got a very high Viswar antenna where nothing resonates. All good antennas, somewhere in the antenna, must resonate first, then it can radiate. Let me repeat that. Very important statement. You will not read it in any good book. Only the smart ham radio operators have this little secret nugget of information. All reasonable antennas that we touch resonate first, then they can radiate. The only exception to that are these super long things like rhombic antennas and beverage antennas. So somewhere in the antenna, something must resonate or you will not radiate with any reasonable amount of efficiency. When you go higher and higher in frequency, the shortest element way up front that can just barely reach resonance is going to act like a dipole and nothing else will resonate, nothing else will radiate. So you slowly go from the log periodic 7 or 8 dB of gain pattern of a 3-element Yagi at all of these frequencies. As you go higher and higher in frequency, you finally hit the forward element. That's the only thing that resonates. You're down to a dipole in pattern. Go higher in frequency than that, and now you've got an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna again. So with that understanding of how a log periodic works, you should be able to predict pretty much how your log is going to work and why it runs out of frequency region. Make the log periodic long enough, they can easily cover a 10 to 1 frequency range. Ain't that nice? And I think there's even been some that have covered a 20 to 1 frequency range. So there's ways that you can modify the design of your log periodic and extend its frequency range once you understand the theory of operation. And from a ham radio point of view, the theory is not too complicated. It's kind of common sense. You dig into the mathematics of what they call the tango factor, in other words, the rate at which it tapers and the spacing between the elements, it gets a little more complicated. But if you were just doing fiddling around with chunks of tubing and mounting it on the antenna and measuring the Viswar with a good swept signal generator, you could design your own log for your particular frequency range, and it wouldn't take you very long, Lou. W2JPW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, Tech, thank you.
Good evening.
K2RIW,
W2JPW.
Well, I was thinking about maybe attempting just that sometime. I recall the company they were talking about at one time of extending the range of this particular antenna. I don't know if they ever did anything about it. In other words, just making a few pieces extra so you could get it up on 6 meters. Which would be kind of nice. That would mean I don't have to put another 6-meter antenna up on top of the tower. And I have less windage that way. I'm always thinking about this because it's not a tubular tower. It's not a big lattice type. Town wouldn't let me have that. I had one here and they took one look at it and turned their noses up at it. I had to get rid of it. So, thank you very much, Vic. For the wind information, I will look that up on Google, see if I can find it. And I wish I had it in print somewhere. They don't publish anything in print on this, I guess. This is something I know very little about. I don't have any background in mechanical engineering, so the specs they sent me with the tower that I have here are like Greek to me because there's nothing you can... Nothing they gave me that they can sit down and just do some simple calculations and figure out what's going on. K2RIW, W2JPW.
There was a article in QST magazine, there was an article in the QEX magazine on calculating wind load in the last few years. So if you check with AROL, and if you're a member, they will allow you to download an article on wind load calculations. The biggest source of that information, the defining document, is TIA, which I think stands for Technical Industries Association -RS-222F, I think is the latest version of that document. That is the defining document for wind load calculations for antennas and tower structures. You can find a very good reproduction of it in the National Association of Broadcasters Engineering Handbook. So a good technical library will have that book, the NAB Engineering Handbook. It has a section on power calculation, wind loads, and guide wires and calculations and all this kind of jazz. Those are the two best ones. Of all the other antenna books I've got, wind calculations are almost not covered, as well as antenna outdoor range measurements are almost not covered. Amazing. Something that we all need, and the information's not there. But you've got a couple of places, and if you have any further difficulty with that, Lou, come on back, and we'll help you out one way or the other. Now, the next person I know of with a question is Mel. Last week we didn't get to Paul, and so I'm going to turn things around a little bit. We're going to get to Paul first before we put him to sleep tonight to find out what's going on in space. I think I've seen a beautiful picture on the news recently, Paul, where Spirit and Opportunity are roaming around Mars, and I think it was Spirit that has just come up to a great big rim of a huge crater 6 kilometers away from where it landed, and now a new spacecraft, the European Space Authority craft with a very high resolution camera, was put in orbit around Mars, and it took a top-down picture of Spirit, or is it Opportunity, sitting at the edge of the perimeter of this great big crater it's about to go into and start exploring. So we're getting some beautiful pictures of Mars, slowly discovering water below the surface. All kinds of good things are happening. Tell us about any of your above, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I wonder if that was the Mars Express that took the picture. That's the European Space Agency satellite that's orbiting Mars. Now, that's been in orbit for, I guess, a year or so now. So I know that has the capabilities, but we also have Mars Global Surveillance Orbit, and that's by us. Mars Odyssey in orbit, that's by us. And then the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, now that's the newest one. That was the one that spent last six months in an aerobraking orbit, bring its orbit to a circular orbit. And maybe that's the one that took the picture. That's the one. That's supposed to have very high resolution. It's actually in a lower orbit than the other three satellites. So that's probably the one. They did say that was going to have the capability of doing that, along with a lot of other equipment on board they've got like 6 or 7 different sensors on that thing to take pictures in different capabilities, magnetometers and everything. So we'll even look for the weak magnetic field that might exist on Mars. Very, very weak. That's probably one of the reasons that Mars didn't have an atmosphere. It didn't have a good magnetic field. And that atmosphere just got blown away over the years. But not, unlike the Earth, we're pretty much protected by any of the solar flares that come in. So it's an interesting planet, and it's going to be more interesting once they get this other thing off the ground, the Mars Laboratory. That's the one that's going to ride around on Mars without the solar panels, and that's going to have a nuclear plutonium generator on board. The power is electricity. That'll probably go for many, many years as well. So we're looking forward to more Mars stories. The recent story I saw recently was in astronomy. You might have gotten that one having to do with Titan, the moon that's going around Saturn. Radar picture taken by Cassini. Titan is really socked in. It's a high nitrogen methane planet. You just can't see to that moon, to the bottom of them. You can't see the land. So, I mean, we did land a probe there. It didn't detect any liquid methane, although they kind of think it landed in a soggy type of land when it did land there, that, right after Cassini had gone into orbit. And they think the only reason for that was because there was probably wet at one time or recently. They think there's lakes made of methane on Titan. And they had probes on the lander to detect it. It would have floated if it landed in something that was lake-like. But now Cassini has taken pictures with the radar. The northern plains, the land landed, Huygens landed in the equatorial area roughly. But this, you know, in the northern area, they see lakes. I saw pictures of it. It looked like lakes to me, and they're claiming that they are lakes of methane. So if that's true, that's the first time on any other celestial object that we've discovered anything that would be liquid-like, although it's not water, it is methane. And in one of the articles, they talk about the possibility of life within an environment like that. You know, who says that you need water? You know, Carl Sagan questioned that back in the early 70s, that maybe you don't need water to have life. So looking forward to some of these missions. Manned missions are still scheduled for the next big one will be in December up to the International Space Station. But if you follow the robot probes, I think they're quite interesting. Many probes that are out there, you have just like you have the Mars Express going around Mars, you have the Venus Express going around Venus, also by the European Space Agency orbiting that planet and surveying that. So a lot of interesting flights, not only, you know, doing good science now, but quite a few on a drawing board coming up. Hopefully they all get the go-ahead, including something that will eventually replace the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Telescope. Back to you, Dick. I haven't seen much on Spirit and Opportunity, except I reported on it about a week or two ago that they're into the winter time up there. So I'll be looking to see these pictures of Spirit or Opportunity being taken pictures, you know, an actual photo from orbit. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yeah, Spirit and Opportunity are really doing well. I think I've heard that they had an estimated life by that definition, if they lasted that long, the project would be considered a success, and they got the right amount of bang for the dollar. And I think there are four or five times the life expectancy. They're into the fourth or fifth life of the project right now, and still getting extremely good data back. Because of the solar angle not being ideal, and this being wintertime up there, and they're not getting quite as much solar energy, so the movements and the measurements are a little bit restricted. I believe at least one of the spacecraft, if not both of them, they've intentionally parked them on the side of a hill so that they're tilted toward the sun so you get maximum sunlight on the solar cells. So was the original definition something like 3 weeks, and here we are 3 years? Or, is that what I'm talking about as far as Spirit and Opportunity's lifetime, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, the warranty ran up at 3 months, Dick. That was it. Steve Squire is the project engineer. He said, you know, but that doesn't mean after 3 months the wheels are going to fall off. You know, we're going to keep running this. And every 6 months or so, they get another allocation to continue driving around further on Mars. And I don't know, if you ever see the layout of each lander, it's amazing. You know, they show you, you know, they'll show you a drawing of all the different locations, the whole path that they've taken. And like you said, you know, they're a good 5 miles away from where they started, and one of them is heading up in the high hills, and that Spirit taking panoramic views, going into another crater. Quite a ways away, but that's its next goal. And Opportunity has gone through a couple of series of craters, so they're both doing well. Yeah, 3 months, and now here we are. Let's see, it would be January 3rd and January 14th, I think, respectively. I think of the dates for Spirit and then Opportunity. That'll be 3 years, Dick. Back to you.
Yep. Fantastic project. Squires did a beautiful job of designing these things, and my goodness, are they working well. like a charm. And I think he's planning a much more elaborate version of these things. I wrote an article, as you guys heard me say, for my astronomy club, the Astronomical Society of Long Island, ASCLI, in which I described the fact that unmanned spacecraft give us a lot more bang for the dollar when it comes to deep space, anything beyond near-Earth orbit. Unmanned spacecraft give us a lot more than manned spacecraft. And I went through the mathematics explaining why in my lifetime and in my children's lifetime, it is my prediction that we will not see a man standing on Mars. It's just too difficult to get him there, and it costs too much, and there's too much life of risk and risk of life and limb as opposed to sending an unmanned craft. You get a lot more for your money. You have much more objective measurements, a slight bit slower, but still it's an extremely good trade-off. So the degree of difficulty of getting a man to Mars is so high, I'm predicting it won't happen. Well, I got an awful lot of flack on that particular article. It went on for 3 pages, and people got very mad at me. They attacked me. They didn't attack what I was saying. That told me something. I made about 8 individual points as to why it's too difficult to get a man on Mars, too difficult, too expensive, and too risky. Nobody attacked my 8 points. They attacked me for saying it. So it's an emotional issue. As is the so-called EH antenna. Bennett, N2FBS, mailed me a beautiful article, which I rediscovered in my pile of mail last December. December 23rd, he mailed this to me, an article about the EH antenna. So when Mel and I dig into what's going on with his loop antenna, this other highly controversial antenna called an EH antenna, the concept behind the EH antenna is that you independently issue the E field with one set of hardware, you independently issue the H field with another set of hardware, let Mother Nature combine those signals out in space to make it into radiation. And the advantage of separating the E from the H in the philosophy of the EH antenna is that you get greater bandwidth, greater efficiency, and get down to the basics. That's the philosophy. And the people who don't study antenna theory very deeply, that seems to make sense. If you've got a background of either formal education in the antenna art and science, or if you've got 20 or 30 years of experience of building, testing, designing, improving antennas with hands-on experience, in either case, you're going to come up with a different point of view, and you're going to be quite skeptical as to whether or not the EH antenna has anything to offer. I'll read you what are stated to be the apparent advantages of EH over a so-called Hertzian antenna, a more conventional antenna. We'll get into that after Mel tells us what he's up to. But there is a relationship here between what Mel's doing and what EH is trying to do. Mel's doing it with real hardware, with real measurements, and real people sending him back information as to how it works. The number of tests of the EH antenna appears to be small so far. There's a lot of skepticism about it. A number of broadcast organizations have said they're going to put up one. Many of them did not, for whatever reason. And so it's a subject to be discussed, but I'm not sure I would put a whole lot of money into it yet. I'm not convinced it's thoroughly proven. Even though the man who edited this article, he runs a company called EH Antenna Systems, a man named Ted Hart, a very sincere W5QJR amateur radio operator since 1948, running this company called EH Antenna Systems. I think he's a sincere guy. I believe he believes in his product. I'm not convinced, though, that his product is all that he would like it to be. I'm going to have to read a little bit more to find out for sure, now that I've rediscovered this article that was mailed to me. Let me also mention the fact that guys will from time to time listen to the TechNet and say, hey, Mel and Dick, they're pretty smart guys, Mel, Dick, Rich, the group, and they'll start sending them letters and emails. When it comes to our response, we promise, so to speak, to give you the best we can verbally. That means over the air answering questions and occasionally on the telephone answering questions. When I get excited, I can speak 150 words a minute. That's the good news. When people mail me things and expect the same response, they're going beyond the stated promise. I cannot promise to give a whole lot of people completely free consulting service by mail. I'm a find and type typer. I type 10 words a minute. It's a very slow mode of communication. And when I first started writing articles 20 years ago, all kinds of people were writing me letters, and I tried to keep up with the mail. One particular guy in Snug Harbor, Maryland, wrote me 14 consecutive letters in a 1.5 month period. Each letter consisted of 2 or 3 pages of questions, typewritten with spaces in between the questions where he wanted answers. On the 14th letter, I suddenly realized this man wanted me to help him live his life for him. That's not reasonable. I was getting 300 letters per year, and that's just one particular guy. I suddenly realized I couldn't keep up with it all. So I make no promise when you mail me something by email or by letter. You may not get a response for 8 months, as happened in this particular case. That letter just got buried in a bunch of other things that I'm involved in. And so I can make no promise, and maybe Mel can. Maybe Mel is a much more efficient guy, and he's truly retired. I thought I retired 6 years ago, and now I'm busier than ever. So I can make no promise. People who mail me things and don't get the proper response, on some occasions are going to get mad at me. Well, you've made an assumption. The assumption you've made when you mail me something is that you're the only person doing it, that I've got all kinds of hours to do this, and that I've made a promise that I'm going to give you a response. I've made none of those promises, so let me give you guys some warning. I've got to repeat that periodically, otherwise people do end up mad at me. Now, maybe Mel's able to keep up with all of his mail. I cannot. K2KEY, our corresponding secretary sometimes, K2IW, the Tech Net. You got it, Mel.
Dick, I have one quick space question for you, WS2N.
Okay, hold on a second, Mel. Go ahead, Paul.
And good evening, Mel. The antenna in Madrid, Spain, part of the deep space network system. We have 3 main ones, Goldstone, Madrid, and Canberra, and Australia, 120 degrees space from one another. Cover the sky all the time for all these probes that are out there, that, the ones that I follow, the deep space probes. I mean, everything from New Horizon to the Venus Express going the other direction to Venus. Now, this network is important, but I read this one in Madrid, Spain is going to be down for, I don't know, a long, long period of time. I don't know, months or something. Bearings went on it. Do you know if they have any kind of backup systems for, you know, to fill in for these, if these things go down? I mean, the article I read said that they don't have another dish like it, but I wonder if they have, like, an array or something that they could use. Wonder if you've ever read anything in that regard, Dick.
Yes and no, Paul. If you visit Goldstone, California, which is inside of Fort Irwin Army Base, I've been there, beautiful 210-foot diameter dish, which I think has been expanded to 250-foot, and that's the main deep space, what do they call it, the Mars dish number 14, I think they call it deep space number 14 of the NASA network. That's the main dish that does downloading and uploading of information to these space probes for that particular longitude, roughly 120 degrees west longitude in California. They have backups on that site of a number of 85-foot dishes. If the main 210-foot dish is out of service, the 85-foot dishes can take over, but because they've got much less area and get a much slower, much more poor signal-to-noise ratio, when you're on the backup dish, you order the space probe to send the data at a lower rate. Signal-to-noise ratio and maximum data rate are a trade-off. When the signal gets weaker and weaker, you can make the receiver, either with digital signal processing or real tuning, one way or the other, you can make the receiver electronically more narrow to suck the signal out of the noise. You get a higher signal-to-noise ratio when you have a smaller post-detection or pre-detection bandwidth. But you can only send the data through that smaller bandwidth at a slower rate. So you order the spacecraft to go to the slower rate, and you go to the backup dish. So each one of the sites that I know of, certainly Goldstone has a couple of 85-foot backup dishes. I believe Canberra, Australia, has a couple. I am guessing that Madrid, Spain, also has backup dishes at 85-foot. So when that part of the Earth is aimed toward your spacecraft, and these ground stations are located every 120 degrees around the circumference of the Earth. So now, no matter how the Earth is aimed, in theory, one of your deep space network NASA sites is aimed at your spacecraft during that period of time. So when Madrid, Spain's main dish is not operational, I'd like to believe the backup dishes at slower data rates can handle it. So you're not off the air, you're not losing that data, you're just transmitting it down more slowly. That's the trade-off. Back to you, Paul.
That's good news. Very good. I was concerned. Very good. I figured it's going to put a stop or, you know, really slow things down. Very good. Glad to hear it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, each of these dishes have gone through, at least the one at Goldstone, went through a major renovation a couple of years ago to increase the accuracy of the azimuth elevation, steering network, servo mechanism, bearings, and they also converted to a brand new transmission line. And that is the transmission line going to the dish right now is what's called beam waveguide. In other words, you know the way a periscope antenna systems work. You've got a periscope antenna system consisting of a illuminating dish, which is a parabolic dish, sitting on the ground aiming straight up. It aims at your fly swatter, which deflects the signal at a 90-degree angle between straight up and straight out to the horizon. That's how a periscope antenna system works. And in between the illuminating dish on the ground and the fly swatter on top of the tower, that beam of energy in between, they call it beam waveguide. The advantage of beam waveguide is that it has no loss. In some cases, it has half a dB of gain, as opposed to running the most ideal transmission line up the tower, you're going to get some number of dB of loss per 100 feet. So if you've got a tall tower and the right frequency region where you can put up a big enough fly swatter, which really means the right number of wavelengths of diameter for your particular system in operation, periscope antenna system can buy you a lot. I've been studying periscope antenna systems for, let's see, I started seriously in 1989, so here I am, what, my 17th year. I've been gathering the materials to set one up in my own backyard, and I'm going to eventually set up an articulated periscope antenna system for 10 gigs and above, and I've got dreams of using it on 24 gigs all the way up to 240 gigs. That's another whole story. So what NASA did on their Goldstone dish is to convert to beam waveguide. So in other words, that signal starting off in the basement of the building that includes the Goldstone dish literally is transmitted into something that looks like a parabolic dish in the basement, and it goes through a series of tubes and mirrors to deflect it all the way up to the sub-reflector in the main dish, which then scatters it onto the main reflector, which transmits it into space, and they end up with much lower loss. I am guessing that improvement they did at Goldstone improved the performance so much, that's the reason why they want to do it on all the other sites. So I think that's part of the updating that's taking place at Madrid, Spain. That's my guess. I haven't read that yet, but I bet if you and I do enough research, we may be able to confirm that, Paul. K2KEY. Now, you've got the whole runway. You're number one on the runway, Paul, ready to take off. Tell us anything you'd like to talk about. And how has your mail been this week? K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay. Paul, did you want to make any final comments?
No, Mal, that's it. Very good. And by the way, I like just one quick one. I like the demo with the AM radio and the remote. Dick. Very good. Very well done. Back to you, Mal.
Okay, thank you, Paul. This is K2KEY. Yeah, very fine, Dick. And yes, I've seen a number of those applications of using the fly squatter technique and locating the equipment down at the base. And I guess that's a great way to go. But it reduced a lot of hardware up on the tower. Let's see. number of things. First of all, as far as E and H plane, you know, during World War II, a very interesting experiment that was done. The Helicrafters Company built for the Navy an installation. In fact, they built it, believe it or not, here in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And they put up, I think they're gone. I used to look for those towers. They had a number of towers they put up on the top of the building, a couple hundred feet tall, these steel, immense steel structures. You know, you see, God knows what they were going to hold, but basically they were dipoles on it. And then they had a whole vertical field also. And the whole idea at the time was that Helicrafters had done a lot of experimentation in this diversified receiver system. In fact, they built the receiver. Now, there's some around. I saw once a reference that there was a couple of them that were still around. Big pieces of equipment. Basically, it was a receiver system that took two antennas in, one from the vertical and one from the horizontal. And it combined the two, and that was the receiver. A number of different IFs, duplicate IFs, duplicate front ends and things, and then most likely going through some system of mixing the two together. Because the final was to hear the station, but they did have meters on the front panel that indicated not only F meter, but also which antenna was receiving the stronger of the signal. And what happened, there was what really came of it, but it was called the diversified receiver system. I wonder if you're familiar with that, first of all, Dick, over.
I flipped the buttons the wrong way here on my transmitter. Yes, when it comes to diversity systems, you can have spatial diversity, polarization diversity, frequency diversity, also angle of arrival diversity antennas. So in the case of spatial diversity, they will set up a number of antennas in a number of different locations, and the idea is that when you get a fade in one location, hopefully you will not get a fade in another location. So therefore, a diversity system has a significant increase in reliability of reception. That's the whole concept behind it. So polarization diversity, I think, is the one that you're describing right now. Mel, go ahead.
Gotcha. Now, it was, of course, you know, understanding the fact, not necessarily that the antenna at the other end, you say, well, the guy's on a horizontal, and that means I should be receiving strictly on a horizontal antenna for best results. So because of Faraday rotation, finding that many times the stations, it didn't fit the pattern. In other words, they expected. So I wonder, you know, with E and H plane, if, you know, this is basically what they're, you know, considering.
The so-called EH antenna, it's trying to separately launch the E field, separately launch the H field, and letting Mother Nature combine out in front of the antenna is the concept. And the concept, according to this article, I could start reading you what Ted Hart, I guess his name is, he feels is the advantage of this particular antenna. Yeah, Ted Hart. He believes the antenna has maximum radiation, only depends on phasing between the two. It doesn't depend on radiation resistance. He believes he gets more bandwidth, higher efficiency. He believes he gets a number of things like that. He's got a list of about 10 or 15 items of advantage over a more conventional so-called Hertzian antenna. If you like, I can bring up this article. I personally am having trouble accepting some of his premises. Everything I know about an antenna tells me you must first resonate before you radiate. And so the EH antenna sort of violates that. When you try to put power into a pure E field, or you try to put power into a pure H field, there is no clearly defined radiation resistance for you to put the power into. Therefore, by the laws of conservation of energy, why would the power couple into the E or the H independently? That's my first question. As you can tell, I haven't built one of these antennas, so I'm not giving it a completely fair shake, and I haven't thoroughly studied this article yet. However, when I first had my first serious independent consulting job 5 or so years ago, a number of people approached me about the EH antenna saying, why aren't we using it for this application? And I was able to, at that time, find a long list of websites where people had made attempts with an EH antenna that were unsuccessful. You got to be careful. Just because somebody said it didn't work doesn't mean that the idea is bad. Maybe he had improper implementation of the idea. But I found a lot of articles where people were not able to make the antenna work, and they came to the conclusion that it was a farce, and I haven't been able to find anyone yet who said that I've really built the antenna, put a pair of them side by side, compared the response of antenna A to antenna B, and confirmed the fact that it's doing exactly what it wants. I haven't yet found one single article where someone has actually said that. So for the time being, I'm skeptical, as you can tell. I'm not writing it off as impossible. I'm just saying I'm having trouble accepting some of the concepts, and I seem to be in the majority on that one. As I said, I haven't yet found someone who has a really good side-by-side test. K2KEY, K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is K2KEY. All right. I guess something to be looked into in the future. I haven't honestly, you know, given it much consideration. I've seen some reference to it, but never pursued any further with it because it'd be a lot of theory. Nobody's yet, you know, published saying, put this up and give it a try. You'll be amazed or something. I haven't seen anything. We'll let it go until some real experimental work, actual work, because on paper, this is the whole thing. Again, I will always emphasize, like you did, that on paper, a lot of times we'll come up with a lot of so-called things that look excellent, but when it comes really to actually building such pieces of equipment, that gets it to, you know, comes a little bit on the impossible side, or trying to do something that physics says that right now is not possible. And I can see why you got the flack with the Mars business. Oh, sure. If anybody brings up anything about, you know, space, especially in mention of space, right away, you know, we should have been on Mars now. I don't know why they held us up or things like that. Of course, when we were doing the Apollo flight to the moon, that was the stepping stone. And we figured that within a few years after the Apollo flight, we surely were going to do the next step, was going to the moon, from the moon to Mars. So, like you say, you see on paper, everybody says, it's doable. You know, we can do this, we can do that. So many ideas have come out of, you know, professional engineers that were with NASA of how to, you know, go to Mars and put even systems ahead of time on Mars that will generate fuels by all kinds of methods, so that when they get there, they'll have enough fuel to go back. Oh, and all kinds of very, you know, I don't know if you can call them fiction, but it's interesting reading. Next thing I was going to say to you about the writing is I attempted. Yes, I'm a lousy, lousy writer. I've never been able to really write really well, and this goes way back. I've written a few things, and I think I've gone through every time where I'm reading a paper because I write it and I read it back and said it makes no sense whatsoever, and rip it up and start all over again and back and forth. So when it comes to, you know, writing, I'm one that honestly will say that I just can't convey what I'm thinking onto paper. In fact, I even have problems verbally many times doing it. So I've sort of shy away from a lot of things. As far as email goes, yes, I get a lot of email. I try to answer them as briefly and as best as possible. And I hope, you know, it makes sense what I send back to them. And it's, you know, it's many times, like I say, it's hard to phrase the answer to their questions correctly. Again, it's not really my cup of tea, but I try to help whoever possibly, you know, has a question, and do my best I can. Next thing, I did go to the Google search on Smith Charts. Very interesting website on Google that has reference to Smith, the Smith chart. And one of the sites tell you that if you'd like to download a Smith chart, be free to do it. And it downloads a beautiful Smith chart, and they call it the Black Magic Design. I wonder if you've been looking at that or have copied that at any time, Dick, over.
Oh, many times. I have downloaded that exact chart. There's two or three websites. One gives you a beautiful high-resolution black and white. One gives it to you in color as an emittance chart. In other words, it's got impedance and reactance, conductance, susceptance. Well, what's the word I'm looking for? The one over impedance. I keep forgetting the word. Admittance. It's got admittance and impedance all on one chart. And so you get a beautiful download if you got the right kind of a laser jet printer or inkjet printer. And it makes a very nice 8.5 by 11. There's probably even a website where you can make an 11 by 14 out of it. So if you happen to be a Smith chart enthusiast that like graphing what you do when it comes to impedance matching, that's a great way to go. The number of engineers who have studied electromagnetic theory and had a one-week course on Smith chart, almost every one of us have, who have gone through a good engineering school. That's the good news. The bad news, I don't think more than 5 or 10% of the electrical engineering students used it enough so that it became second nature. Like, you really learn how to ride a bicycle. 20 years later, where you haven't ridden a bicycle for 20 years, it only takes you a very short period of time to pick it up again. Because most engineers didn't get a chance to really ride the bicycle called Smith chart enough when they first learned it, that it didn't stick with them. And they've got to go through the whole process of relearning it. I've had to almost relearn it because day in and day out nowadays, in my consulting business, I'm doing impedance matching. And it's a dog of a problem at times to try to get the right standing wave ratio below the right number over the right bandwidth. And some of the antennas I'm working on these days, the customer wants the standing wave ratio to be better than 1.06 to 1. That's 35 dB refraction coefficient. 1.06 to 1 is what the customer wants, and he wants it over a 3% bandwidth. You go to any antenna manufacturer on planet Earth, and you hit him with that set of specifications, he will say, you're completely crazy. Tell me what the hell you're smoking. Oh, by the way, get out of here. I don't even want to talk to you. It is so crazy compared to everything they've ever done, they will not accept that specification. Well, I now have a patent for an antenna that does that, and it's about to be mass produced. So it can be done, and there are certain applications. It's a very desirable thing to do. There's a certain kind of antenna that requires that.
You make it on the ham bands?
It's that it happens to be in a ham band, yes. The antenna happens to be covering a ham band, 902 to 928 megacycles, which is 2.8% bandwidth. So yes, that antenna now exists. And the usual reason you want the standing wave ratio of an antenna to be low is so that you have high transmitter efficiency. However, if you're building a RFID interrogator, an RFID reader circuit, where the transmitting and reception takes place on the exact same frequency, you want the reflection from the antenna to be extremely low so that your own receiver is not being jammed by your own transmitter. So therefore, there is a modern day requirement for super low standing wave ratio antennas. It's no longer for the reason of efficiency. It's nice to have it. Anything beyond 2 to 1 gives you 95% efficiency. Beyond that, you say, hey, it doesn't matter. It's a law of diminishing returns. If you're only talking about transmitter efficiency, yes. But if you're in the modern-day world of very fancy receiver circuits that using a Homodyne receiver, which is a kind of a CW radar, then you would like the antenna reflection coefficient to be 40 dB down if you can get it. There's definite reason for that. I know I'm a little bit off to one side on this. By the way, you said you're not a good writer, Mel. You are a good speaker. That's two-thirds of the problem. If you can speak the problem out, and people can understand what you're saying, and they get value out of it, All you've got to do is speak into a tape recorder and have somebody convert that into typing. My first few articles, because I wasn't super good, like most engineers, I wasn't great at expressing myself on paper. Thank goodness I married a lady who is a teacher, who teaches English, then in high school, now in colleges. So she was my writing editor for the first 5 years of all my articles. I've now learned most of those techniques. I don't require as much editing these days. The first problem when it comes to good writing is to admit that whatever you put down at first is not perfect. It's going to have glitches in it. But if you can speak the problem out, if you can organize your ideas mentally so you can talk it into a tape recorder, two-thirds of the problem is gone. Converting that into writing and cleaning up the English a little bit and putting the commas and the periods in the right places and the right word tenses in the right places, any good English teacher, a person skilled at teaching English, can do that for you. Just got to find the right editor. So getting the idea, no matter how sloppy, on paper first, and having the faith to do that, even though you know it's on a yellow sheet of paper and it's got arrows all over the place where you're plugging in words and you're crossing out words and changing word tenses and so on, don't let that discourage you. That's the way good writing looks at first. Thank goodness I do most of my composing these days on a word processor where you don't leave black marks all over the page on the thousands of times you do wordsmithing. One of the recent articles I published, I think I rewrote that article 15 times before I finally sent it on a, what was it now, a listserv. To put that much effort into an article going to a listserv seems silly. All of a sudden, a number of organizations picked up that article, and it got republished in a whole lot of places around the world. So I guess it was worth doing. So you have to admit to yourself that the first time you write it, it's going to be terrible. Don't let that discourage you. To rewrite it a few times doesn't cost that much. And that each time you rewrite it, it gets better and better. And have somebody else proofread it. The best proofreading you do when you read nice and slow, because we all have certain glitches in our speech, you will miss certain idioms every time you read it. Let someone else, even somebody who is not technically oriented, Ilona could read it for you, even though she's not technically oriented, maybe. She could read it for whether or not it's good English and say, hey, you shouldn't, a preposition is not to end the sentence with. If you know what I mean. She can correct all those errors for you. So don't be discouraged. Nobody is a perfect writer the first five times they put it on paper, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RL.
Mel first, then we'll pick up Steve. Mel, give us a couple of paragraphs before we pick up Steve.
Okay, now Roger, I have the XYL who's an expert typist, and been typing, like she said, all her life, and really can do a beautiful job of making it look on the paper correctly, but not what I meant. She's typed up, she says a number of my, and she tried to straighten it out, but when I read it over, I says, oh no, this should have been here, this should have been there, and I start chopping it up, and then we have an argument and everything, and I says, oh God, forget it. It's too much to go through because, yes, true. When you start over and over and then it gets away from it, you know, you get away from what you're really originally trying to convey. I seem to go off in tangents. This is the problem, you know. We start, like here many times, we start talking about one thing and wind up in a completely different subject. We went from, quickly from the Smith chart, which I downloaded, like you say, a number of the phenomenal Smith charts that they offer you for nothing, which really surprised me. And I have the one right now in front of me that I'm working with right now, the complete Smith chart Black Magic design, which is came out excellent on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And I didn't expect it to, you know, be so beautifully sharp, you know, distinct printout. So I'm very thankful that you gave me, you know, that hint to, you know, look for it. So before I get into what I was basically alluding to with the Smith chart, where I've gotten to where I am right now, you want to pick up this, the other station, Steve, I believe it is, and see what he has to say, and then we'll get to amateur radio and antennas, Dick, over.
Very fine. Yes, Steve, I have the impression Steve uses Smith Chart every day of his life, as I do. On my network analyzer at the salt mine, there's a beautiful Rodin-Schwartz network analyzer, and half the time I display the data in rectangular form, just as pure standing wave ratio or reflection coefficient. The other half of the time I display it as a Smith chart in order to find out what's going on at what particular frequency range. And I believe that, Steve, you use Smith chart for doing most of your impedance matching on the amplifiers you work at. KF2RL, KTRIW in the TechNet.
Yes, you're right. When I'm designing an amplifier or a matching network, of course I use the Smith chart. But I was just going to mention on the subject of Smith chart that there's an excellent applet at Besternet.com. If you look under, I think it's tutorials and applets. It actually allows you to put in like an impedance. Actually, you drag your mouse over to where the impedance is, shows you the number, and it's got different elements like series inductance, transmission line length, shunt inductance, shunt cap, resistance, and it allows you to actually learn how to match things. It's a nice little applet to learn on.
Get us that one again, more slowly, phonetically. Somethingnet.com. Turns out that my microphone is getting a little bit too mushy. I'm about to try to go over to one with some high-frequency notes. I think this particular repeater these days is a little bit shy on the high-frequency notes, and so is your mic a little shy on the high-frequency notes. So go slowly. That applet you're talking about, blanknet.com. Give it to us slowly and phonetically, Steve. Go ahead.
Okay, it's www.bestnet.com. Baker, Echo, Sierra, Sierra, Echo, Romeo, November, Echo, Tango.com. And if you look under the tutorials and applets, you'll see a bunch of things. In fact, I can go there right now and tell you. I think they have some stuff with DSP, and they have the Smith chart and a couple of other things.
Okay, now there was a guy 15 years ago going around teaching a set of courses on modeling on a computer networks and solving amplifier and receiver circuit problems. His name was Les Besser, B-E-S-S-E-R. So is that what this is? B-E-S-S-E-R-N-E-T.com. Is it by Les Besser? Back to you, Steve.
I believe it is by the same guy. Let me see now. Besternet, I have to read the thing, but I believe that's where I got it from. I get, RF GlobalNet and a couple other things, at work, so I just happened to stumble upon this one. And I thought it was really good for technicians and such to learn what's going on with the Smith chart, how to use it for impedance matching and, whatnot.
Okay, let me give you a warning, Steve. Both the microphone I'm using and the microphone you're using and the response of this repeater is such that nothing of our speech higher than 1.5 kilohertz is being repeated. In other words, you and I right now sound like we're talking through a bale of cotton. So when you rapidly say Besternet, nobody in his right mind could have gotten those letters out of what you said if you didn't say it slow. And even you even pronounced it slow and I didn't get it. Until you gave it to me phonetically, that word absolutely did not come through. Now we know. Besternet, Baker Echo, Sierra Sierra, Echo Romeo, net.com. So one word, .com, Besternet. And you're saying it gives you good applet, and I think you're saying it gives you a lot of information on use of the Smith chart and impedance matching. Give us a few more words about what that particular website gives us, Steve. Go ahead.
Okay, I was waiting for the tone, but I guess it's not there. Basically, it actually allows you to do some impedance matching. If you put in a certain impedance by dragging your mouse over to the part of the Smith chart, you can actually add different elements in there, like a series cap or a shunt cap or, transmission line length or whatever.